Bye.
Bye.
What's happening, guys? Okay, there we are. Right. My producers are traumatized. They've had to be door destroyers this morning.
They've actually committed a crime, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They're breaking and entering and destroying property. But it's cool. I think we'll manage. We've got an awesome guest joining us in just a short while, which is another reason I'm pleased we got the studio organized, because he is a very, very interesting man with a very interesting story. I've been reading his book, and I think you're going to enjoy speaking to him too. His name is Antonio Iozzo. He's going to tell us his story, and it's just something that could happen to anybody. It's not like this guy made bad decisions and then, you know, his life started spinning out of control. He's a tremendously successful, hugely enthusiastic, optimistic, cool guy who was living an unbelievably successful life. And then suddenly it all went tits up, Leanne.
Wow.
And you know all about that.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that.
A thing or two.
Yeah. Well, yes, especially about titties. So just a quick couple of things. We've got to make a remark about the weird weather over the weekend, even though I think probably most of us are sick to death of talking about the weather already, because boring people talk about weather, but it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of videos that came out of KZN that were unbelievable, right?
Yeah, no, really. My brother was traveling. He was in Zanzibar. And when you go to Zanzibar, I mean, you're not going to pack the warmest things, right?
No.
So I said to him, I don't know what to tell you, but it's really cold. I don't know how you're going to get off the plane and survive. You better double up on your speedos.
and Zanzibar is a whole different
climate
to what you had here.
Not only KZN, but obviously everyone feeling the cold.
But yeah, it was nice to see some people having fun with it as much as you could have, even the people who were stuck in it. And I know that two people did pass away during from exposure during the KZN issues. But there were a lot of people who were stuck right in it for 20 hours and made the most of it. And there was one TikTok I saw in particular, and I ended up following her journey. And they were sending out troops because it was a garage about 3 kilometers away. And they ended up like putting all the warm clothing they had onto these people, sending them off in the snow to literally trek to go to the garage for supplies.
What do you do? I mean, you can't, if you stay in your car and you run out of fuel and your car isn't, you know, you don't have a heater on or something, you're going to get colder and colder and it's going to get worse and worse. Snow is starting to build up.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do? We're not a country that's used to this.
No.
And if you get out of your car and you try to traipse through the snow, that might also be fatal in a much worse way. You're like, you don't have clothes for midwinter. In fact, there are probably people who are going to KZN because they had the weekend, maybe a long weekend planned, at the beach. So they got like beach clothes.
Look, we had enough warnings in the weather, but we didn't know it was going to be that drastic. Okay.
Please, man. We're South Africans. We go, how bad could it be?
But no, she filmed some cool stuff with her and her friends in the car. They were using everything they could. She had her eye mask on and taking the piss. And then some rescuers arrived, some Afrikaans looking guys, and this was a black girl who was following with her friends. And she said, "Oh, Jacobus has come to rescue us." Yeah. But then Jacobus started on the opposite end of the, you know, the onward traffic. And she filmed and she said, "No, sorry, guys, I've just realized we're black. He's going to start that side with the whites." So, yeah, she just showed a sense of humor, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Listen, it must be a very, very scary thing. I did see a lot of people who rallied to help. There were people in the surrounding areas who came out and
brought
blankets and helped people. And, you know, that's the nice stuff that you see when a horrible situation occurs, when circumstances. And it doesn't look like it was a fun thing, but it kind of must be if you survived it. You go, oh, we got through. My sister and her boyfriend were on their way back. They came back on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
So they just sure. made it. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And they had their dogs with them.
Oh.
Yeah. That would have been awful.
And interestingly, one of the people who passed away, I'm not sure who the second person was, but the first lady was on in a taxi. And she was with other people. So there was like the body warmth was there. And she was actually fine. She ended up walking through a supermarket to get supplies. And that's when she collapsed. And that was from exposure.
Oh, so she's the only one who died.
There were two people. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, horrible. By the way, B says in the comments, the universe really hates KZN. There's always a drama there. I don't know if that's fair.
I don't know.
But what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Once we were on a school tour in the Drakensberg, says that Don Kitty, and it snowed. We didn't have gloves. We had to use our socks as gloves instead.
Hopefully clean ones.
Yeah. Barely Vocal Media says, welcome back, Gareth. Did you bring back a Bulgarian babushka? No, but I thought about it. I thought, you know, these guys who get the Russian brides, they're not entirely stupid. It's
really?
A good deal. Well, it's a good deal for her. It's a good deal for him.
I don't
deal with some moany South African woman. And I can get some moany Russian woman who moan a little bit less because I won't understand her. I'll be like, what? I don't understand you. Why are you moaning?
That 90-day fiancé or whatever it's called. They always seem, the bought brides always seem
what
so upset and grumpy.
Well, not as upset as they'd be if they stayed in their home shitty countries. Tell you that.
They expect a lot, eh? More than a South African woman would. I'll tell you that much.
Well, you think?
Oh, yeah.
Please, to get out of Ukraine at the moment, it's a war zone. Don't tell me it's worse here.
I promise you, these women are like, they expect absolutely everything.
Well, everything is better than nothing. And what you have to do, it's a negotiation. You settle for what's in the middle. Everything, nothing. You can come and live with me. You know, you don't get a salary, but you can go and shop. You can cook. You can have.
I know these women won't cook. Not the ones I've seen on 90-day fiance. No,
half of them gone.
They end up divorcing because they haven't got everything they expected in terms of like luxury, high end, lots of money, dripping in gold, massive rings, in the salon the whole time, in mansions.
Oh God!
They want Porsches.
So basically, the same as most of the girls I'd meet in Joburg on a weekend.
Worse.
Ugh, what a pity. The chances of maybe I have to go back to Bulgaria.
Maybe.
Bulgaria, they I don't know, they seem very humble to me, but they're not comfortable with being happy. They really don't smile. We had the grumpiest waitress in the world on Wednesday last week. We ate like a salad lunch type thing at this golf club. It was like a golf club, and they were doing the Bulgarian Amateur Open. So you would think, and look, there was no one there to watch it because it's like, who's in the Bulgarian Amateur Open?
Yeah.
But anyway, Ben and I sat down for lunch. This woman came. She resented and loathed and hated us for sitting in this restaurant. You could see she was like, what do you want? You want a club sandwich?
And it, what do you want? Are you sure it wasn't one of those
you
restaurants
sell it?
Where they treat you badly on purpose?
No. And she was... Look, I don't think she's very happy. She probably lives in some like Soviet apartment block. So I don't think she's got a lot to get excited about on a day-to-day basis. But she really didn't like us. Like when we ordered, she was going almost like she didn't want to be there anywhere but there. So you know what? I take back everything horrible I've said about South Africans. We're good people.
Mm.
We're fun people. We're nice, friendly, optimistic people.
Well,
I like it.
You know what? There's a waitress who spoke out recently on social media, Mihlali.
Yeah.
And I've actually got some pics there, James, if you have them.
Okay, what's this?
But she's a former Pretoria restaurant waitress, Mihlali Nobavu.
Mm-hmm.
And her TikTok went absolutely viral. And now it's put a cat amongst the pigeons. She was speaking about a restaurant called Babel out in Pretoria.
I've never heard of this restaurant. Is it famous?
Yes, apparently very, very popular. Okay. And a lot of the people who went there said they had no idea what the waitresses and waiters were going through there, because the service was always amazing. They particularly said the service was amazing. But this isn't the only restaurant, so I don't want to just call them out. But her video has allowed...
They don't pay their staff?
They pay them terribly.
Oh, God.
And they treat them terribly. In fact, the treatment is worse than the payment. They are required to buy their own uniforms, which, A, is a bit of a problem. I'm trying to remember the list of things. They only get tips, of which money comes off of their tips and goes to the restaurant. Okay? They said that because...
Why would... Okay, so listen, this is not a slave state. You don't have to stay. Why would people stay in a job like that?
Well, they don't. These people have been leaving in their droves.
And they've apparently shut the restaurant down now.
I'm not sure.
That's what people are saying in the comments.
Well, there you go. But they would be charged for breakages and lost cutlery. So if customers took a knife or fork, okay, they would be charged for that.
I feel this, Mihlali. I'm sorry that this had to happen to you and that you had to end up in a shitty job situation like this. But let me tell you this once and for all, because we've got to get to our guest. If you're in a shitty job and you hate it and they're treating you badly, you are not a slave. You must leave. Use the law of 2 feet. Get the hell out of there. There's no one to blame but you if you stay in a horrible job. You have to have the self-respect, like she did, clearly, because she put this video out. Good for her. But all the other people, stop letting someone abuse you. You live in a free country, and capitalism can save you. You're not a slave. Mm. Get out. Go. Start your own thing. Go work for someone else. There are not all terrible bosses out there. Some of them are not so bad. And if you're willing to work hard in a place like that, trust me, there's some other place that'll hire you and you'll have much better working conditions. You won't have to buy your own uniform and you'll get paid properly.
And it's not Bulgaria.
And it's not Bulgaria, so people aren't as grumpy. All right. Antonio Iozzo holds a very prominent position in Johannesburg's business community. He serves as the CEO of IUM, and I'm sure you've heard of Body Action Gym. I certainly have. His journey as an entrepreneur has been exceptional. He's attracted all kinds of media attention, and the right kind of media attention too, it's worth saying. He's been featured in various publications. He's even graced the front cover of Entrepreneur magazine. That's where I first saw his face. He's led an impressive 3 billion rand conglomerate. They include diverse sectors like insurance, construction, hospitality, business ventures, all kinds of interesting things. His success is attributed to his commitment to setting an example, building trust and loyalty among customers, employees, and business partners through unwavering integrity, visionary leadership, innovative thinking, and relentless hard work. But we want to talk to him about his book, which is called Slaying the Dragon. Now, after that intro, you're probably thinking, well, this guy sounds like he's got it made. Like, this is the happiest guy in the world. What could possibly be interesting about the story from here on? Because we all like a good success story. But this guy's story took a really weird turn. So apparently, he went in for an operation and he ended up addicted to opioids. And I'm not going to paraphrase his story because he's here to tell us himself. But first of all, man, nice to have you here.
Thanks very much, Gary.
And thanks for coming in first thing on a Monday morning. I know how busy you are. I have seen you and heard of you a long time ago already. And I knew you were this big macher in the business community. And I didn't know about all of this stuff until I saw your book, which you only released, you launched it publicly, what, 2-3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
So congrats on the book, but what a story.
Yeah, it's been a crazy ride. It's been a really crazy ride.
How does someone, I gave that intro on purpose because it sounds like a PR. It's been written by someone in PR, but it's true. I gave it on purpose. I read the whole thing because people, when they hear about all of that, they're like, oh, this is perfect. Life just, it's bliss from there on in. That's what you thought probably at the time.
Yeah, listen, I was living probably my best life at that stage. I'd taken up superbike racing. I was getting to the track about 2-3 times a week, really enjoying it. And a freak accident at a race in Kilani in Cape Town changed the course of my life.
Yeah, so I mean, these things happen with superbikes. So you knew that there was a chance of it, but you go into hospital. They're going to operate on you. They give you something for the pain, which happens to everybody who goes into hospital. Leanne has been in the hospital so many times. Surprised she's not an opioid addict. But
I didn't even know that they, I mean, how long ago was this?
So it was 2018. So, I mean, I didn't even know what an opioid was.
That's the thing. I don't think they're allowed to give them out anymore. Am I right?
No. They are giving them out freely still? In South Africa. That is the problem.
Oh, jeez.
So in the States, they've tightened the tap. But, I mean, my daughter went in for her tonsils last year. They gave her Oxy.
Really?
OxyContin, huh?
His knee was given Oxy. Now, Oxy is the go-to drug in South Africa.
I mean, I've just had hip surgery and I didn't even check what I was having as a painkiller.
Yeah, and they give it to you in the form of a patch or OxyNorm is the trade name of the...
So Antonio, just tell me what happened because you didn't realize there was a problem straight away.
No, so I mean...
So you feel a bit groggy, you wake up, and then, as you say in the book, you started to pick up these signs that something wasn't lekker.
So, I mean, in hospital, I was in ICU for 2 weeks. So, I was given OxyNorm, one tablet 4 times a day. I was also on morphine and I was on pethidine.
Yeah.
So, oxycodone takes about a week for your body to get really addicted to it.
One week.
And then when I left, they gave me a 2-month supply and take it at one tablet every 4 hours. And that's how I took it. When the tablets ran out, that was when the depression, the body sweats, the aches started setting in. And that's the first time that I started to research what are these tablets. So I was really knee deep in the shit by the time I realized what was wrong.
So when you say you're knee deep in the shit, like you obviously couldn't control and look after the business at that point because you were trying to do both.
I did both. I mean, the first time wasn't the worst. I mean, the first time I actually, once I read up on it, about a month after I knew what the problem was, my wife went away on a girl's weekend away and my son was out racing. And I actually went cold turkey myself over 5 days. And I
managed to get off. What did that feel like?
And that was the worst experience, the second worst experience of my life, because I tried again. Later on, and that was even worse.
Mm.
And I got off. The thing is that Oxy really does help for pain.
Mm.
And so the accident was in the March. I went back for another surgery in the November to take my plates out. And they gave me Oxy again.
No.
And you'll take it for the pain. And I thought, you know what? I can get over this. I've managed to conquer this tablet once before. I'll be able to do it again. And when the time came to getting off, I really didn't want to go through the withdrawal. So I actually went to my doctor and I said, listen, what do you give someone who needs to get off Oxy? And they didn't know. So they phoned a pain specialist and they came back with this new super tablet called Suboxone. And she said, just pop it under your tongue. In 20 minutes, we'll start working and we'll take all the withdrawal symptoms away. And lo and behold, it did. It was the most amazing tablet. And so I took this tablet. What I didn't know is they just transferred me from one opioid to another.
Oh, come on.
So from a short-acting opioid to a long-acting opioid. And my worst experience was when I tried to go cold turkey off this tablet. Mm. And then realized that the withdrawal symptoms are like 5 times worse than oxycodone. So, and that's what the drug rehabs do. When someone goes into rehab for heroin or for oxy, because for me, oxy is just legal heroin.
Yeah.
It really, really is. When you come out and the guy says, listen, I'm clean. Yeah, you're not taking heroin, but they've just transferred you onto another opioid.
Mm.
And then you leave addicted to something else.
I mean, and it's as recent as 2018 that we didn't know what was going on. I mean, I've watched at least one documentary and two, you know, like Hollywood movies, which are highlighting the opioid crisis now. And it's popping up in medical series all the time.
They've got a big problem
in America. Now we know, but we didn't know until very recently.
The thing is, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is, if you look at a lot of those Netflix documentaries, it almost looks like Oxy's for the poor. It's for the poorer communities. You know, they highlight these poor towns in the States. But Oxy doesn't discriminate. It catches a lot of people. The thing is, if you're wealthy or affluent, you're too ashamed to actually come out and say that you actually got a real problem.
So that's what I found interesting about the book is that you are very open and honest and vulnerable about what you went through. And that's not something you meet CEOs who they're not willing to do that very often. People who've built up businesses because they want to seem like they're superhuman.
Yeah.
Right. And you even said the first time you went cold turkey and you decided I'm going to get off this stuff. I mean, that's the same kind of mental strength, the same kind of perseverance that you need in business if you're going to do what you've done. But even you admitted that it was impossible the second time. And the first time you got through by the skin of your teeth.
Yeah.
It's an awful, awful thing. The human body almost doesn't have the resources to be able to beat that kind of drug on its own.
Listen, what you don't realize, and I mean, if you've never been an addict to an opioid, I really, in the beginning of my life, I used to really think happiness was a choice. And I had a guy working for me at my gym, and he was bipolar, and he used to come in some days and say, listen, I'm really not feeling good. I'm not happy. My chemicals aren't right.
Mm.
And I was quite hard on him. I used to say, like, listen, get over yourself. Happiness is a choice. I choose to be happy.
Right.
And what I soon realized is that happiness is not a choice. It's a chemical in your brain.
Mm.
And if your dopamine and your serotonin levels are out, doesn't matter how good your life is, how much money you got, how healthy your kids are, you are totally depressed, thinking about suicide.
You just made me depressed. Yeah, I go around saying to people, happiness is a choice.
Pull up your socks. Yeah, you can do this. Yeah. Pull yourself out of it.
So that's changed. You don't say that to people anymore.
I don't say that. I actually went back to him and apologized for the way that I actually treated him.
Really? Okay. So help me understand. Again, this is not something that you put yourself in the way of. You know, there are people out there right now, perhaps, who are injecting heroin into themselves. Drugs. They're finding various versions of these over-the-counter medicine, stuff that you can get at the pharmacy that will get you hooked for life. And these people are choosing it. You didn't choose that. This happened to you as a result of an operation. It took you a while. How did you eventually break that cycle that you said you went from one medication to another? But how do you get out of it? Because you're not on anything now.
No. So I had tried so many times and failed so many times to get off the oxy. So like you try and you start. I mean, I went through a stage where I was really abusing the drug. At one stage, I could take a box of the stuff at once just to feel.
And what does it feel like?
The thing is, when you take it in the beginning, within about 20 minutes, it starts working. And you get a slight happy feeling. And you just feel happy. And it lasts literally for about 20 minutes. But that's the term chasing the dragon. That's mm-hmm. used in heroin. It's the same in oxy. You're now going to start to chase that happy feeling. So when you take the drug, you're waiting for that happy feeling. Over and above the pain subsidy that you get, you're now chasing the happy feeling. Your body starts getting used to it, and eventually one tablet's not enough, so you take two.
But I need to understand, because I've never been on morphine or anything else, and heroin clearly has some really good feeling, otherwise people wouldn't do it. But are you saying it's just a mild happiness, or is it like a euphoria?
It's a euphoria, like you really feel good. Like if you had like your happiest, like you just feel great. Like you're happy, you just happy in yourself.
Everything's lekker, you're fine. You feel like you are on a holiday with your family and friends. You're just having a good time. Is that kind of the happiness? It's like a background happiness?
Put yourself back to like when you were a kid and you had to wake up in the morning and you're leaving for Durban on your vacation.
So it's like
you're just excited and you're happy. Heroin is an elevated feeling of that. So heroin is more than that. Oxy is a version of what you get with heroin. So that's what you actually start to chase.
I just want to go to Melinda's comment here. Sorry to interrupt you, but she says, this is Melinda who helped you get the book together. This conversation is such an important one in the bigger landscape of talking about addiction. Well done to Antonio for having the courage to talk about the dark shit. That absolutely is one of the reasons that I wanted to have you in here this morning, because people don't talk about this.
No, they don't want to.
So you go from the happy, and then obviously there's a great sadness and depression that comes after that, because feeling back.
You need to keep taking the tablet, because when you take the tablet, you're artificially inflating your dopamine levels in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that you give your body artificially, your body is going to stop making it naturally. So when you stop taking it, you now don't have that dopamine production, and it takes your brain quite a long time to start getting its production going.
Mm.
So it's in that period that your serious depression, your bouts of depression. So in the quest to chase your happy feeling, you start taking more and more tablets. But eventually, you never get your happy feeling back. That happy feeling never comes.
Oh.
The reason why you're taking the tablets is so that you're not depressed. Then trying to get off. So you go through stages where I'm abusing the tablets. Then now I'm trying to taper down and I'm trying to take my one tablet every 4 hours. The problem is it's such a fast-acting drug that it takes 20 minutes to work, works for about 40, 45 minutes, and then you've got to wait another 2 hours before your next mm-hmm. tablet. So it was like just the biggest roller coaster ride. Mm. So while I was working, I'd take my tablet, my office door would be closed. As the tablet started to work, I'd open the door, tell my PA, listen, I can see people for 45 minutes. As I feel the body sweats and the body aches starting to come in, I'd close my door, I'd lie on my couch, and I've got to wait out another 2 hours. And then I say torture. I'd sweat my whole body from my socks, my underpants, my pants. Everything gets wet. 2 hours later, I take another tablet. I go shower. I change my clothes, open my door, and I'm ready to see people again. And that would happen about 3 times a day.
What a way to live.
It's torturous.
It was terrible. And I put on a big facade. I mean, my staff didn't really know what was happening. My telltale sign was that you would catch me maybe in a bad mood on the way down. But it was a big facade that I put up.
And the family and friends, did you show any of that to them?
No, they didn't really know. I mean, my wife knew I was taking the drug, but she never knew how bad it was at the office.
Did it put pressure on the relationship?
I think she was worried about me. But what I didn't want to do is, I mean, I come home and she says, how was your day, babe? I'd say, no, it was all good, babe. Had some meetings, was busy. I wouldn't tell her that I took 40 tablets. I sweated my clothes out 3 times, thought about committing suicide a few times, changed my clothes 3 times.
All in one day?
And that happened every day.
For how long?
The worst part of it was for about 18 months, 2 years.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So this is in like 2018, 2019.
It was 2020 as COVID hit.
And so COVID, this is what I'm getting to, is like COVID comes and now you've got that in addition to all of this stuff. It's like a nightmare.
Yeah, and I was building a multi-million rand office block. I was expanding the business. I decided to renovate our house and move out. And I think that's just my personality. As things start getting worse for me, I just start taking on more responsibility. So I don't actually have to think about how bad things are going.
That's interesting to me too, because a lot of people would be relieving themselves of responsibility. You added new things to it, but were you as effective? I mean, was there any diminution in your ability to make decisions, to do business? Because it sounds to me like you were almost like, you know, you get these people who are functional alcoholics, that they can work from Monday to Friday or whatever, but then over the weekend, they're basically like zombies. And they get back to work on a Monday and they climb right in. Is that how you were, or were you less effective? Are you able to make rational? Because you know you're taking way too many of these things and you're not an idiot. So you're going, I know this is probably bad, but how do you rationalize that?
So now I would actually say I was super effective. But if you understand how opium or opioids work, your body becomes so used to them. That's how overdoses and deaths happen. Is that someone goes from maybe going to rehab and not taking the drug for 3 months or 6 months or a year, and then they go back to it, and then they go back to the same dose that they were on when they stopped, and their body can't handle it.
Mm.
So my body just got so used to these tablets that I would feel nothing. I wouldn't really get drowsy. I would still
have clear thought. And you didn't lose or gain weight. There were no awkward signs.
I still trained through my depression. I went to gym. I'm very consistent in whatever I do. And I think it was my consistency that actually pulled me through.
Yeah.
Because you wake up in the morning, and if you think about waking up totally depressed, like you don't want to do anything, and you've got to like will yourself to put your socks and your underpants on and just get going in the morning. And you're like on this hamster wheel. And at the same time, I got this back of mine that was really, really screwed up. And the pain, I could almost justify why I was taking the tablets because the pain is there every day.
Mm.
I mean, it was a serious crash. I should have been paralyzed. I fractured my T7, broke 14 ribs, punctured both lungs. I've had multiple spinal fusions, multiple operations in the States. So I could justify taking the tablet.
Are you in pain right now?
Always.
Mm.
Antonio, do you think that being in this situation with money, and this is going to be a controversial point of view for some people, but it's almost worse because you can afford to get as much of the drug as you need legitimately. You can afford the operations and everything else that keeps you going. Whereas if someone has nothing and they have nothing to live for and they don't have any money and they can't afford the treatment, they kind of just give up and then they probably die.
I would say that having money was my saving grace.
Really?
Because honestly, I could honestly tell you that if I never had doctors and chemists that I could go to get my tablets, I would have gone straight to the street.
Really? You would
have gone straight to the street and I would have become a heroin addict. It happened to one of my son's friends. My son went to St. John's. One of the moms there, she fell down the steps at home and she fractured her ankle and she ended up getting plated. And she was prescribed Oxy. And she did what I did in the beginning. She got addicted. She started fraudulating her script and going to DiscM and Clicks and just repeat scripting. And eventually she got blacklisted and she couldn't get her prescription filled. And she ended up going to the street. She became a heroin addict. And 4 months later, she overdosed and died.
Oh, my God.
And I mean, the thing is, as well, at that point, you stop buying food and you stop giving your body nutrients. You'd favor buying a drug over keeping yourself alive.
You'll do anything for that drug.
Mm.
I mean, when I detoxed the first time on about the Saturday night, I was seriously contemplating breaking into the Bedford View Pharmacy. And I had a whole plan in my head of how I was going to do it because I really, really wanted my tablets.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So Crazy South African says here, what was the turning point for you in deciding to seek help? What advice would you give to others who are struggling with addiction but haven't taken that first step yet? Because we haven't got to the point yet in your story where you managed to, and I encourage people to read the book, Slaying the Dragon, which we'll talk about in a minute, but just complete the picture here for people like this who want to know, where's that breaking point? Can you identify a specific place and time where it happened?
So I always wanted to get off. So that's why I was continually trying and failing with this tablet. I think the real turning point, I went away on a skiing trip to Austria with my family that are like in my mind, I really didn't want to go on. And I think my mind was reaching breaking point from all the trying and all the fighting, just trying to stay taking this tablet normally without consuming copious amounts of it. And I went away on this holiday and above the depression and the body aches, anxiety setting, which is the first time I've ever had anxiety in my life. And if you've had anxiety, you'll know it's like this feeling in the middle of your chest. You can't sit down, you can't stand up. You think something's going to happen, but nothing's going to happen. And now I've got anxiety, I've got depression, but I must still get up in the morning and go ski and look happy with my kids at breakfast. But all I want to do is I just want to die.
Yeah.
And so I came back from this family holiday. And 2 months before that, I'd gone to my GP to ask him, is there anyone that he could recommend that's like a pain specialist that could help me? Not the doctors that I'd been to. And he had recommended a psychiatrist. And when my PA phoned to make the appointment, there was like a 2.5 month waiting list for this woman. So she made the appointment, but I'd actually forgotten about it. And when I came back, just happened to be that it was that week. And she came to my office and she said, listen, don't forget you got this appointment. And I first told her to cancel it. And I said, oh, no, I don't need a psychiatrist. I was so depressed. I said, I don't need to tell someone about my depression. Just cancel that appointment.
Sure.
And she actually said to me, listen, just go. You never know what could happen. Just go and see her, see what she has to say. And it was a lady called Dr. Layla Perouk in Rosebank. And I went out to go and tell her I told her my whole story, my drug addiction, my operations. And she said, listen, well, the first thing is that we need to get you off the oxy, because oxy is very fast acting and you can never taper off such a fast acting drug. So she put me on a patch called buprenorphine, another opioid, a strong, long acting opioid.
Mm-hmm.
And she did the conversion and she transferred me to these two patches, 40 milligrams. And over a period of the next couple of months, she started weaning me off the patches. So from 20 to 35, a couple of weeks later to 30 to 25. And eventually I got down to 15 milligrams. And the patches only come in 5, 10, and 20. That's the size that they come in. And when I pulled off the 5, a couple of days later, I went into the most hectic withdrawals. And I quickly made an appointment. I went out to go and see her. And she said, oh, no, once you get to this point, this is where you now stay. You stay on these drugs for life. And I was like, what do you mean? She says, no one gets off buprenorphine.
Really?
You now just manage it.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, but I want to get off. And she said, well, listen, it's extremely difficult. Not many people get off. And so I went home, and this patch that you stick on your skin, it's got like a contact strip. I measured it. I worked out 10 milligrams is equal to 4 mils on the strip. And I started cutting the strip over a period of probably about 8 months. I managed to wean myself off the drug myself.
And that was without medical help?
Listen, my wife went to go and look at the rehab centers. The problem is that they would put me back onto what I was already taking.
No, right. No.
So that's...
So you did this all on your own?
Yeah. And the book is like a self-help guide. I mean, it tells you in detail how I did it and how I managed to get off.
And is it something that doctors wouldn't recommend?
Or? They don't even know about it. I can tell you so.
Wow.
If you know how... And I mean, I've become an expert on opioids. But buprenorphine is such a strong opioid that when it attaches to your pain receptors, no other opioid can work. No morphine, no oxycodone. So if you're on that drug and you go in for an operation, which is what happened to me in my first operation in the States, none of the painkillers that they give you work. So I went in for my first op where they replaced my vertebra, took out one of my ribs, and it was an 11 and a half hour op, and I woke up and I had no painkillers. Doesn't matter how much morphine they gave me, none of it was working. And doctors in South Africa are prescribing the patch for pain and oxy. So the one is countering out the other. They don't even know what they're doing. Doctors are ignorant. They don't really know about these drugs.
I'm absolutely astonished at the way that you went through this and did it all on your own. I think it takes a huge amount of willpower. It obviously takes a massive amount of kind of swallowing the pain, because you have to, right? That's not... You said you're in pain right now. It's not going anywhere. The psychiatrist helped. The change in
she
medication.
She got me on the right path.
Right. And the change in medication helped. But ultimately, it comes down to how much do you want this?
Yeah.
I mean, there's somebody who says here in the comments, there are so many functional addicts out there. It's actually scary. I wonder how many people are on painkillers every single day, and they just don't see a way out. Like the psychiatrist said to you, this is where we keep it now. You're just going to have to manage this.
I mean, when I was trying to taper off and get off the Suboxone, which is this little tablet that you take under your tongue, because it doesn't come in different sizes, the one doctor told me to start filing it with my wife's nail file and just file a little bit off every day, which I thought was a good idea, and I thought it was working. And all of a sudden, I started getting depressed, and so I went to make an appointment with a psychiatrist, and I mean, they prescribed me SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antidepressants. And I mean, as you go to a doctor, they're just going to prescribe you tablets. I think the biggest thing that I've seen since I released the book is how many people have come up to me that are addicted to something, whether it's benzodiazepines, antidepressants, it's sleeping tablets.
Yeah.
Everyone, there are a lot of people that are addicted to something and have got no way out. And I think in South Africa, it is becoming a real epidemic, because we don't realize that this drug is now here in South Africa in a really, really big way. And it is the go-to painkiller in South Africa at the moment.
Spongo Kushle says, stories like this make you embarrassed about our healthcare industry. We can do so much better. And Bitcoin Boot says, Yara, the SOC's pain tolerance should be through the roof. So you obviously, did you ever do any drugs before this, like recreationally?
I've smoked weed.
And it doesn't even compare.
No.
Totally different thing. No.
I don't smoke. I don't drink.
You don't drink at all anymore. So you are substance free at the moment in every way. It's a total cold turkey. You don't even think about it anymore. Is there a trigger that could ever get you back into that kind of behavior?
I don't think so, because the short-term gains of taking that tablet are really not worth what comes afterwards. So the pain relief that you'll get, your slight happy feeling that will last 20 minutes, what comes after that, if you on that tablet for about 4 or 5 days, the depression will get you.
Does it feel now that you're sharing this story for the first time? Because you said you were sort of suffering in silence for like 18 months when nobody knew. You were just pretending.
It was almost 5 years.
You're pretending everything was okay and holding it together. And
that in itself is
putting up
so
a front
exhausting.
And
so, I mean, where I came out the first time was when I came back from this ski holiday in March.
Yeah.
And I called all my exco and my senior managers, about 30 people, into the boardroom. And I just came clean with them first. And I mean, I told them my whole story, how I got addicted.
Were they shocked?
I was crying. They were crying. I really just, but it was like a big weight had just been lifted off my shoulders that I was able to tell them I wasn't ashamed. And I think that was the turning point where I started moving in the certain direction of actually getting off.
Dirk has an interesting question here. He says, how many families and colleagues are aware of what you are going through but don't say anything? Is it our culture to stay quiet on these things? Again, did you feel a pressure, first of all, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, as a father, as a husband, as a man, to kind of just cope and deal with it? Because it's a very South African thing, you know, you make a plan, you get through it. Do you think that without us becoming soft and, everyone sitting in front of Oprah and crying, there's like a balance, and maybe South Africans don't talk enough about this stuff.
I don't think, not just South Africans, I don't think most people are going to talk about their addictions.
Yeah.
Whether it's alcohol, drugs, whatever it is, no one's going to tell you they're addicted to sleeping tablets and they can't fall asleep.
It's the fear that drives you, because you know they're going to make you stop.
The thing is, I had no problem telling people that I was on Oxy. And I didn't keep that a secret.
Well, it was like a legal thing.
I could justify it. You know, I've got pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why I'm taking it. The secret was how much I was taking at certain times during that period.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that you don't want people to know that you are really just consuming vast amounts of it. So that was the secret.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else asked, can you actually refuse opioids or morphine when you're in hospital? I don't think you can. It's not up to you. It's up to the doctors.
You can refuse Oxy. I mean, I wouldn't refuse morphine. Morphine's not the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Oxy, if you're given it for 1 or 2 days, it will be fine. But, I mean, I left Milnerton Hospital with about 15 boxes of the stuff.
Yes.
So maybe some doctors are conservative and they give you maybe 2 or 3 tablets for your pain after an operation. That's not a problem. But I think a lot of the time you're given a box or two and you take it.
Yeah.
And trust me, you do get addicted to that little happy feeling that comes.
Well, I mean, just, by comparison, it's nothing. But after my hip replacement, I never looked at the ingredients of my tablets. And the doctors will say to you, take it every 4 hours, even if you're not in pain, because you're going to be in pain.
Well, listen, I never questioned the doctor up until that point. I mean, my first operation was
Most of us up to COVID never questioned anything from the medical fraternity, right?
That's true. We just trust.
Doctor says, if you take this, I'm going to do this to your back.
Yeah.
I'm going to insert these plates. What do you say? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you really have got total 100% trust that whatever they're doing is in your best interests. And maybe they think they are helping you.
They probably do. I mean, that's what they're training.
That's what they've been taught.
And they're also human.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that we did survive before Oxy. You know, before Oxy arrived on the scene, you went in, you got morphine, you maybe got some Sinaleve, maybe a Tramacet tablet. But there were operations prior to Oxy.
Well, I mean, there were people in wars that had limbs cut off when they didn't have anesthetics. They survived. I don't think it was pleasant.
The craziest thing that I never knew is that when I went to my doctor and I said, listen, what other pain tablets can you prescribe to me that are not opium-based for my pain?
Yeah.
And quite plainly was told, every pain tablet that really, really works in the world is opium-based. So whether it's morphine, pethidine, oxycodone, Tramacet, Tramadol, all of them are derivative of an opioid.
Tramacet I've been on. And then there's, of course, the wider, the global and corporate involvement as well, and how the pharmaceutical companies are profiting off of this.
I think they definitely are into annuity income.
Mm-hmm.
And annuity income is keeping you a repeat client.
Well, get you on something for life, right?
Yeah, no benefit to you taking something and getting healed.
Mm.
They need you to keep buying. And so whether you're on heroin or you're on Oxy or you're on buprenorphine, you're on something. And you are on the hamster wheel and you're just running around.
And what is life like now for you? Because you've always been a disciplined person. You've always had routines. So you kept yourself in shape. You pitched for work. You did all the things that you were responsible for. You took on new projects, dad, your husband, all of these things. What's life like now? Is there a different rhythm? Are you doing anything differently this time to what the kind of life was that you were leading before the operation, before the accident?
I think I've gone back to where I was prior to the op. I think during my addiction period, I was going through the motions of doing everything that I used to do before, in the hope that I would get off and I would come right.
Mm.
I'd say my headspace, I'm in the best headspace I've ever been in my life. I'm motivated.
Well, you're sharing the story for starters. That's
I'm
good.
Driven.
Yeah.
I love my wife. I love my kids. I love my office. I love my staff. We've got really big things planned for the future. I love disrupting the market, and I've done seriously that in the gym space.
Yeah.
I'm doing it in the insurance space. I've opened up a new restaurant, and which is doing really, really well. So, I'm a workaholic. I love work.
Just as a complete aside, you mentioned the restaurant. That restaurant they've just shut down in Pretoria. Do you agree with me that these people, if you're unhappy in a job, you must leave?
You should definitely leave. Listen, there's definitely different pay structures on when they pay waiters and waitresses.
Yeah.
Some restaurants pay basics. Some don't.
Sure.
Some are just tips only. Some make you pay for the uniform, some don't. You can definitely find really good restaurants that will look after the
But
staff.
You choose to be...
You choose to stay.
Right, exactly.
You don't have to work. Then.
And also, I would say that people often will find a coping mechanism, and I'm not talking about jobs now, but in their lives, they might go through a tough patch, and then they find some thing that makes them feel better. Alcohol, cigarettes,
chocolates.
Weed, chocolates. All of this stuff, right? I mean, you know how I feel about fat people. I've said some terrible things about them. But all of these things are addictions, and they all have the same basis as your story. Like, it's very, very hard to chemically get yourself off of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, what you don't realize is that your whole life is governed by a set of chemicals in your brain. And the minute your production is off, you're in serious trouble. And I mean, some people do need drugs. You know, if you're bipolar and your chemical composition is out, you do need it, and you're going to need it for life.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people are on stuff that they really don't need. They've just somehow got trapped.
Yeah.
Do you think some people are more susceptible than others? That's a question that came up in the comments, and I've often thought about it. I've thought, oh, well, you know, and I'm sure you were like me before this happened to you, and God forbid it should happen to me. I hope I'm as strong as you were. But I still go, oh, please, I'm not going to get addicted to anything.
I don't have an addictive personality.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I don't need that. I have lots going on in my life. I feel stimulated at home, at work, I've got a full and busy and happy life. Why would I ever get addicted to something?
No, you don't need that. That's absolute rubbish. That's why I say this drug will catch you, and, and it can catch anybody. Because I didn't need any of that. I mean, I got my adrenaline rushes from my racing superbikes, racing supercars. I mean, I was living the high life, loving it. And from one minute to the next, you are chasing your little tablet around. I mean, I used to store that tablet everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I had bottles in my bag, in my car. If we went away on holiday, I'd make sure my wife's bag had it, my son's bag, my daughter's bag, just in case I lost it somewhere down the line.
Mm.
You become paranoid.
And it became your number one priority to make sure you had it, right?
Listen, drug abuse is very selfish. You think about that before anything else. And you justify it.
Mm.
Do you ever think about how it felt to be on that stuff and go, like, either get the chills and go, I'm so glad I'm out of it, or go, oof, to feel that way again would be worth it?
No. I mean, and that's what I say. The happy feeling that comes with taking it is you can't
so
compare to what comes afterwards.
Yeah.
And once you know what comes afterwards, I mean, to go back to it, I think you're just an idiot.
So what we've learned here is that superbikes are a terrible idea. I mean,
basically,
that's what I'm taking away. Superbikes are a terrible idea. Adrenaline rushes. Just be calm and live life where your dopamine levels are more or less regulated. I mean, what do you do for a high now? What do you do for fun now? Because you're not the kind of person who's just doing ordinary stuff. Is it business? Does that give you enough of a high?
No. I still like my supercars. I just came back from a Lamborghini trip where we rode from Cape Town to George through all the mountain passes.
Wow.
And that was really, really fun. The thing is, my personality is to always do whatever I'm going to do. I'm going to do it on the edge of my ability. I'm going to push myself right to the edge. And I mean, that's why I've been airlifted off the mountain in Austria. I cut my whole knee open. I've got two operations.
I've
torn my bicep boxing because I took that to another level. I mean, even playing tennis, I broke my scaphoid bone. I mean, it's ridiculous. So
your wife must want to like cotton wool you. Ball you before
you
leave.
She doesn't want me to do anything dangerous. But I think that is one of the secrets to my success, is that I'm not scared of taking risks. I've taken a lot of risk in business. I'm not scared of failure. But it does come with its consequences.
Mm.
I think that this is a terrific book for everyone to read, Slaying the Dragon. You can get it at good bookstores now. We'll also put the details up on the website so that you can follow up on that. And there's what it looks like. Antonio's book. It's a hell of a story, man. I'm glad you made it through.
Thank you.
I think it's great for our economy here in South Africa that we've got guys like you who are getting things moving. I'm very happy for your family and your friends that you made it through too, because God alone knows this could have ended very badly.
Mm.
Yeah, listen.
You know, do you ever think of like what the alternate route, the other off ramps might have been, overdose?
Listen,
I
definitely thought of committing suicide many times. Mm.
How would you have done it?
I would have overdosed. I would have taken about 6 to 8 boxes at once to try and make sure. And I mean, I think the thing that stopped me was, one, if it didn't work, I've seen what's happened to heroin people that have overdosed but have lived through it, when your brain is now starved of oxygen and you become a bit of a vegetable. And then the other one was if my wife had found me, which would have been really, really terrible.
Yeah.
But you contemplate it, and it doesn't matter how good things are going. That is like you're out. You think that's the best bet for yourself.
Mm.
Well, I'm hoping that very few people who are listening to this now ever have to go through it. But if you have anyone in your life who needs to hear this story, I think that you should read this book. It's really an incredible, very vulnerable, very honest, very real breakthrough thing in some ways, because everybody always thinks, oh, well, heroin addicts, they're those people you see on the streets injecting themselves.
Yeah.
This is people you see on a daily basis. You don't know what they're going through. You could be dealing with someone today at work who's quietly going through this, and you don't know.
And I'd say most people want to get off.
Mm.
Of course. I'm sure they would, because they know this thing is controlling them, right?
Yeah.
And nobody likes to be out of control. No one wants their life to be in someone else's hands or in a pill's hands.
No, it's
amazing.
It's a terrible place to be.
Well, listen, you've got lots of really cool things happening. We'll keep in touch with you, because I think that this is just the beginning of a whole new chapter in your story. And of course, there are lots of business things that we've got to talk about too. So I'm really excited about that.
Cut Out Fritz says there, Antonio, if Spider-Man dies tomorrow, you are my new hero. But only if Spider-Man dies.
Yeah, and listen, I do have to give credit to Melinda as well. She's an incredible writer. She's written some amazing books. She has understood addiction from every direction. And I think she's a very, very smart person to have encountered. I don't know how did you meet her?
I waited a year. The woman that does my videos for my business put me onto Melinda.
Yeah.
But she was busy with a couple of other books and she couldn't see me and I waited. And how we did it is that she would fly in from Cape Town. She'd sit with me in my office for about 4 or 5 hours at a time, record me. I really wanted this book to be in my own voice. So she'd go and write the first couple of chapters. She'd send it to me and then I'd rewrite it. Mm. So it was a really collaborative effort putting this book together. But it took me about a year to write it.
Yeah.
And I decided to write it while I was still getting off the drugs. So I was in my weaning off phase with the patch. But I was that convinced that I was gonna come off.
One last thing. Were there any people who were not supportive, who you thought were a bit judgmental, who maybe had a really bad attitude to you owning up to this and confessing everything and writing the book? And
I haven't been told it, but I'm sure there are a few, but they won't say it straight to my face. Probably.
No, those are the kind of people that you
rotten people.
They're happy for you to keep lying to them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, listen, I think definitely struck a nerve with a lot of people where, and that's why I say I've had where people feel safe that they can come up and talk to you about their own problems. It's amazing how many people are going through their own struggles.
And people whose kids are on stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that must be the most horrible thing of all, because as a parent, you're watching your child spiral.
What you don't realize, it's probably some of the most successful people are the ones that have got some of the biggest problems. They're just hiding them.
Mm. There we go. Well, that's why your story is so unique. So thank you, Antonio.
Thanks very much.
It's a great pleasure to spend time with you. And yeah, I'm really pleased you've written this book. I'm pleased that we've got to hear a bit of the story. And great comments here. People just absolutely loved this. So I think Arthur says, tip of the iceberg, shows how deep in the shit South Africa is. No one doing something about these drugs in this country. I mean, I think the street drug problem is probably way worse, but there's some like veneer of acceptability about drugs when they're given to you by a pharmacy.
Mm.
Then it's okay. Yeah. And everybody goes, oh, well, this is fine. There are enough doctors and pharmacists involved here. So shop. But I can't be
remember,
in trouble.
You can buy cigarettes and alcohol as well. And those can be deadly.
Right.
They are.
All right. Well, there's the high note that we can leave it on is you can beat this stuff. You just have to be as extraordinary as this man over here is. So you know what? Prove that you are. It's a life worth living. So there we go. Thanks, everybody. That's all we got time for this morning. We will catch up with you on Wednesday back here. Enjoy your public holiday tomorrow. Be good if you're not, take photos.